Production support comes from Closets 2, providing organized and expanded closet and storage space for home, office, and garage using a variety of systems with no major renovations. Closets 2, owned and operated in Bloomington, 332-2233. Smithville Telephone Company, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, offering bundled packages, high-speed internet, and wireless phones. Smithville Telephone, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net.
Welcome to Noon Edition. I'm Bob Zaltzberg, editor of the Herald Times, and today we're going to talk about environmental issues in Indiana and about changes in the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. Joining me in the studio is co-host Mary Catherine Carmichael, and we have three guests with us today. Tim Maloney is here. He's the senior policy advisor for the Hoosier Environmental Council. IDEM Assistant Commissioner Scott Nally is with us, and also IDEM Assistant Commissioner Dan Murray. So if you would like to join us on the program, there are a variety of ways. You can phone us at 855-0811 in Bloomington or outside of the local calling area, 877-285-9348. You can follow us on Twitter. You can follow us at Noon Edition, or you can visit wfiu.org/noonedition. So we have all our bases covered.
Yes, you do.
If you can't reach us, you've got to be under a rock somewhere.
That's right. Drive on over to the telecom building. No, don't do that. All right. Thank you, guys, for being here. You drove down from Indy today. And Tim, we're glad to see you back. Return visit.
Thank you.
So let's start out by talking about the mission of IDEM. What is the mission and the history of the Indiana Department of Environmental Management?
Scott Nally, our mission is to protect Hoosiers and the environment while allowing for a prosperous economy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's pretty simple.
Keep it simple.
Yeah. Okay. I know there have been some changes in your operation recently, and I think there are different ways to look at it. I know that there have been many groups that have been very critical, saying that the department has done away with the enforcement division, but I did find your. I'm leafing through some papers here. I found your original press release this morning that actually talks about the reorganization and suggests that it was done to reorganize compliance and enforcement and to make things much more efficient. So why don't you? Okay,
sure. I can speak to that.
Right.
This is Dan.
Dan, go ahead.
We've been talking about this for several years at our agency, and what we were trying to do for the last 4 years is, one, improve compliance rates. It's our goal to have all Indiana regulated entities in compliance. That's good for the environment. It's good for community relationships with businesses and so on. What we found, though, after 4 years of trying to figure out how to improve compliance rates, that we had been unsuccessful. We hadn't moved the bar at all. What we also found is that it was still taking us 6 to 12 months, sometimes even longer, to resolve enforcement cases. Once we did observe noncompliance, still taking around a year to get those sources back into compliance and resolve the cases. Well, we started looking at what other models are out there, what we might be able to do things differently. We talked with EPA, and EPA had two different models, one where the compliance group is separate from the enforcement group, and that's the way IDEM had it previously. However, the other half of their regional offices across the country had compliance and enforcement together. And what that means is the compliance inspector, the one out in the field who's observing the source and understands that source the best, is also the one that is involved in resolving that compliance issue all the way to the end. They identify it. They work with the source and what is timely resolution, what is an appropriate penalty, and then work to get that source back into compliance in the most efficient manner. We chose that other model. We were unsuccessful, and over the years the agency has shown that it hasn't been a very successful model in improving compliance or resolving compliance issues. So we simply chose the other model to bring those two groups together and have that responsibility in one area. We have not done away with our enforcement program or responsibilities or any of the things you might be reading. We simply have brought that responsibility under one program, compliance and enforcement together.
Now, this took effect the first of the year?
Right around there.
The first of the year. And what kind of impact have you seen? Has it had time enough to tell you whether it's really working or not?
We have had a few cases in our office, because one thing you have to think of is now we have to rewrite our procedures, have new flow charts on how we send information through the office and so on. But we've already had a few cases where the inspector would do an inspection literally a week ago, and that referral folder would already be on my desk to review, to now work with the source in writing that agreed order, getting that signed, how that source will return to compliance, pay the appropriate penalty, and move on. Literally a week or two after the inspection, where in the old model that would be 4 to 6 months after an inspection by the time the case was drawn up, referred to a separate office, where now a case manager has to become familiar with it, draw up the paperwork, get it back through the system for review. We're already seeing results. We're not all the way there yet, but early on we've had some that the inspectors have taken on this new task and done very well.
Mm-hmm. For the very uninformed, who do you deal with the most? Are your noncompliance issues, are they large industries, smaller businesses? Who do you work with most often?
It's a mix.
Really?
A mix. It is. We get I would say on volume, the number of cases, it's probably the smaller entities, those that don't have in-house environmental managers, mm-hmm. understand their responsibilities very well. Mm-hmm. And then we do have some sources in Indiana, some large ones, that are either very aging facilities, and that sometimes leads to compliance problems. But then also we have some sources that don't do a very good job complying.
Mm-hmm.
And
so some kind of willful noncompliance.
I would say some, maybe not willful, but knowing mm-hmm. that the management system isn't working quite right in that organization, and they're repeat customers to our compliance program.
I want to bring Tim in. Tim Maloney, Senior Policy Advisor for the Hoosier Environmental Council. What's your reaction to the changes that IDEM has made?
Well, we have expressed some concern and criticism about the changes, and I think for two reasons. One is related to process. Generally speaking, the changes came forward without a lot of communication with stakeholders or affected people or opportunity for public input, and that's a concern for a lot of folks. On the substance part, it's I guess the jury's still out as far as we're concerned on whether this will result in an improvement or not, and I think again having more information and communication with the agency and understanding the basis for the changes and some analysis that led to the changes would be helpful for the public to evaluate their merit, and so far we haven't seen a lot of that.
Well, both Dan and Scott were very candid in saying that they felt like the old structure wasn't really working mm-hmm. as effectively as they would like. What was your evaluation of the old structure with the enforcement division being separate?
Well, there have certainly been enforcement concerns and issues for some time at IDEM and predating Dan and Scott and even this administration that have been the subject of criticism. So the goal of improving the enforcement process at IDEM, we support, but we want to make sure that it's not just change for change's sake, but will result in real improvements. And there are notable examples where cases where the enforcement process didn't work. And one, for example, would be this recycling company in northern Indiana, Vim Recycling, that's had a record of chronic problems there and has even led to proposed legislation in the Indiana State House as a result of that. So we want to see improvements there. In addition to just the agency's efficiency, it's important that their activity be effective as well, and that's where I think we still need to be convinced on that point.
Scott?
Yeah, we're in complete agreement on that. Obviously, you know, we established metrics when we first got on board a little over 4 years ago. And like Dan alluded to, we were not moving the bar at all on bringing people – one, timeliness, and then the rate of enforcement or compliance in this case. And on the VIM case, he's quite right. That's a prime example of one that gets caught in process. And then to make matters even more complicated on VIM, now it's tied in court. Mm. So we have the Attorney General's office who steps in and picks up the case, and then they represent the state in court. And we've asked – we've been in front of a judge several times now and have asked for various things, and now you're just tied in court. That's the unfortunate thing that is out of our control. So we try to do what we can to control. Mm-hmm. In this case, try another model, see if it works. Because what we knew what we were doing was not working.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have people who have called us. One of our callers is was a little impatient, but we hope that he'll come back. Our other caller is Sam, and Sam's on the line. Sam?
Hi. I wondered what people there can say about the report in today's paper about experimentation on, quote, clean-burning coal at our power plant, and whether they're – is any association with scientists rather than operators on that? I'd be glad to hear what people have to say about that.
All right. Dan, I think, is going to go first. Dan?
Sure. Well, I haven't read the article, so I'm not sure exactly what type of experimentation there has been with clean-burning coal. But I'll speak just for a minute about clean coal. And we do believe that coal can be used in a clean way, and many of the projects now, the ones that are coming to us, are not conventional coal-fired plants. They are gasifying coal or using coal and transforming it into a liquid state prior to being used. And in the case of gasification, which we do support, you can remove 95% of the SO2 emissions prior to actually using that now synthetic gas, and when you gasify the coal, and over 60% of the NOx emissions. So we believe that coal does have a place in our state's energy future. Our energy system is largely dependent on it today, but we are promoting only the clean coal technologies going forward because now you can remove the pollutants prior to emission. So I'd like to see more of that. I'm not sure if this experimentation that was in the article today is that type of coal technology, but we are promoting the gasification and removal of those pollutants prior to emission.
Tim, do you want to react to that?
I, too, did not see today's story. Clearly, there's a great deal of discussion and research going on with ways to improve the environmental performance of coal, and we think that has merit that research is going on and look for ways to do that more cleanly. But there has been so much emphasis on this idea of clean coal technology that we're losing sight of a more important long-term goal of moving towards cleaner forms of energy and energy efficiency technology, and that is where we'd like to see the emphasis be in the policy forum and research forums.
Wind, solar, that sort of thing?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I want to follow up on that in a few minutes, but John, our phone caller, is back, so let's go back to the phone. John, thanks for coming back to us.
I am not quite as much concerned about process as I am results. And one of the barometers that I use on how well Indiana is doing environmentally and managing the environment is whether or not our creeks, streams, and rivers can be used for swimming and for eating fish from. So we have a lot of warnings out there. And so that's what I'd like to know is when will we be able to swim and eat fish from all of our streams, creeks, and rivers?
Good question.
Scott?
Yeah, that is a good question. And the answer is a little complicated. A couple of things I can attack that kind of a little bit on. One is 4 years ago, we had a significant large backlog of our wastewater treatment plant permits. Those are the communities out there that needed to treat their water and then discharge into our lakes and streams that we fish from and swim in. And with that backlog meant that they were administratively extended under the regulations of when they were first issued. And then over the years, those regulations have ratcheted down to provide cleaner water for us to swim in and fish in. And now that we've been able to get most of those backlogs, we're down to just a handful left of wastewater treatment plants, and there's a couple of them up in the northern part of the state that we're wrestling with on some anti-deg issues. But as we get people to come into those new permit restrictions, then you'll see that buffering of eventually cleaner water. You know, it takes time. Mother Nature takes a little bit of time to become, you know, she's resilient, but to catch up, and it allows her to catch up. So that's one way to kind of tackle that. It's a complicated. And then the mercury issue, which is what he's probably referring to on fish. The more air emission controls that, you know, we can assist some of our regulated entities into achieving, and as they ratchet down some of the PM 2.5 and SOx and NOx requirements and mercury catch, you'll start having less of that being deposed or deposited in our lakes and streams and rivers. The unfortunate thing is it's such a global – I mean, a lot of what we get for deposition in Indiana was not necessarily generated in Indiana, which is what makes this question incredibly more complicated. It's global. It's what's coming from the West or very far West, China, Japan, India, that do not have as tight restrictions as we do in the United States.
Well, I know that we here in Bloomington began wrestling with this issue 35 years ago about with PCBs, and there have been issues with eating the fish in the local streams. Can you give us an update on that? Have there been any bans on eating fish from these streams lifted? Do you anticipate that at any time?
Don't anticipate. We just recently updated our 303D list, which we do that biannually, and that's the listing of impaired water. So at least we can get the communication out there to the folks that, hey, these are some of the streams that are impacted. And then that also allows us, and we're going to talk about some of the economics here shortly, to focus some of our efforts on those streams and rivers that are on the 303D list so that we can try to get better assessment data, try to look at those that are impacting it, maybe further reduce some of the wastewater treatment discharge requirements on them.
Okay. Tim?
Well, clearly we need to do a lot more to improve our water quality from a number of respects, and not just controlling pollution, but implementing prevention practices that eliminate the discharges altogether. And there's a lot of good work being done in that regard, and we'd like to see more state investment in pollution prevention technologies. On the aspect of mercury pollution, we really feel that Indiana missed a big opportunity a couple years ago to implement mercury pollution control program on power plants, which is our biggest source of unregulated mercury pollution.
Is that airborne?
Airborne pollution that through atmospheric process ends up in our waterways and then in the fish. Indiana could have acted by implementing a strong and technically feasible rule to control that pollution, and instead we relied on the federal rule, which was subsequently thrown out in court as being not consistent with the Clean Air Act. So we missed that opportunity. I'm sure the new administration's going to come back with a new proposal to address that. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, we're still seeing a lot of mercury pollution out there. So,
All right. Our topic today is the environment in Indiana. It's one of the topics that when Mary Catherine and I do the fundraising at the end of the year, people call in and let us know what they want to talk about. The environment always comes up. So we're thrilled to have three great guests here today: Tim Maloney, Senior Policy Advisor for the Hoosier Environmental Council, and Scott Nally and Dan Murray, who are both Assistant Commissioners with the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. You can join us in a number of ways. We are Twittering now.
We aren't sure we know what that means, but we're doing it.
We are Twittering, so follow at Noon Edition. You can also visit us, wfiu.org/noon edition. Visit us online, and two phone numbers, as usual, 855-0811 in Bloomington, 877-285-9348 from outside of the Bloomington calling area.
Now, we've talked a lot about what you as an what your organizations do. What can individuals do? Let's say they're aware of an issue that maybe somebody's dumping inappropriately. Maybe the business they work for, they're aware of some inappropriate things being done there regarding the environment. What can individuals do to help along these lines?
Actually, we just recently updated our website at IDEM to include a citizen's guide on it, which is an online citizen tool where you can click into the citizen tool. And if you see an open dump or you see somebody open burning, exactly what phone number to call and who to contact or who to email.
Mm-hmm.
And we just recently updated that. So I would definitely encourage folks to either use our spill line, which is published, or also get on our website, take a look at the citizen guide, and then use the citizen guide to contact the appropriate people within the agency to address their concerns.
Can they do that anonymously?
Yes. Okay. Oh, yes. And then we have our whole CTAP program where they can call over to OPPTA, our Office of Pollution Prevention and Technical Assistance, and discuss things confidentially also.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I was leaving an IU basketball game and somebody had thrown a can out the window of their van, and this woman picked up the can, walked up to the window of the van, knocked on it, said, "Excuse me, you dropped this," which I thought was a wonderful citizen involvement. So
sure is.
It was great. I wanted to go back to what Mary Catherine mentioned before about wind and solar, and talk about whether where Indiana is in this. I know that we've got some wind farms in the northern part mm-hmm. of the state. I had a caller, I can't remember mm-hmm. if it was a caller, or an emailer, or somebody recently talked about. Perhaps we should be looking for industry in the southern part of the state to support more wind farms in the northern part of the state instead of other kinds of industry. So where are we on this?
Efficiency and renewable energy are part of our state programs. We have several different grant and loan and tax credit programs to incentivize those types of projects being implemented. We do have one of the largest wind farms in the country now in northern Indiana. We're promoting all that we can based on what we have to work with today. I know that Tim's group has plans to try to promote furthering that through requirements. But right now our agency's position has been that we want to support that type of activity and let the market drive that. But as soon as there are requirements, we're ready to implement those.
Can you describe a wind farm? What does a wind farm actually do?
What does it actually do?
Yeah, okay. How does it work?
If you could picture, well, the traditional windmills that come up in my mind are the ones that look like the Dutch type with the big blades. Now they look like very large airplane propellers, very, very large. In fact, sometimes 150 to 200 feet across from tip to tip. If you can imagine those spinning, and they look rather slow when they're spinning, mm-hmm. but since they're so large, as they spin, they turn through magnetics, generate electricity in the turning and electrical fields that are generated. But you have to use the power right then. And that's one of the disadvantages of wind power, and the fact that we promote it as a part of our state's energy policy, but it needs to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. Because I think last year that wind farm produced power less than half the time of the available hours. So the other time you need electricity, you need something that's a little bit more reliable. So we do promote a diverse energy platform, wind, solar, renewable energy sources like biomass. But we still think that coal plays a part there, clean coal, and that when it's dark and when the wind's not blowing, people are still going to want electricity.
Mm-hmm. Tim, do you want to react?
Well, we've hardly scratched the surface of the opportunities in clean energy technologies, and so our group, along with a lot of others, have really been pushing for policy changes to do much better at that. One possibility that now 27 other states have done, and Congress is considering, is a renewable electricity standard that requires a certain percentage of our electric power to come from renewables, wind and solar and biomass. And that's been a very successful policy approach in these other states. Indiana has very substantial resources for producing renewable power, including wind and biomass in particular. We also have a great deal of manufacturing potential. A recent study puts the potential at as many as 40,000 jobs in the renewable energy manufacturing sector, and such as manufacturing turbine components and those kind of things. There's a company in Bedford that does that. One of our steel companies in northern Indiana is manufacturing turbine components. It's a huge opportunity, and it really needs to be more than just a free market, because we have plenty of government intervention on behalf of coal and more conventional energy sources, and it's time we have the same level of public focus on renewables and energy efficiency, which are much cleaner to operate, are cost-effective now, and can help keep us competitive in the global economy.
And interestingly, it's a kind of a whole new industry, so there are job opportunities. I know that the solar farm, if you will – or not solar, I'm sorry, the windmill set up in northern Indiana has created a whole new industry there of people who are building those and learning how they work and then servicing them. And it's amazing. It's just a whole new trend.
Yep. All right. We've hit our break time. So I want to remind you that you can talk with Tim Maloney from the Hoosier Environmental Council, or Scott Nally and Dan Murray from the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, if you just will join us in the second half of the program. You can also find us on Twitter. Go follow at Noon Edition on Twitter. So we'll be right back. You're listening to Noon Edition.
You're listening to Noon Edition on member-supported WFIU. You can take WFIU programs with you by downloading our podcasts. Podcasting is a convenient and easy way to download audio files directly to your computer, iPod, or portable player. You can download podcasts of full-length programs like Noon Edition, Ask the Mayor, and Harmonia, or short features like Kinsey Confidential, the Ether Game musical mini-quiz, as well as movie, play, and opera reviews. Find out more by going to our website, WFIU.org. On Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, the WFIU News Team brings you expanded and in-depth reports on topics affecting South Central Indiana. Listen at 8:33 a.m. and 5:45 p.m. every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to catch that day's feature. If you miss one, that's okay. They're archived on our website, WFIU.org, and the best features from each week can be heard Saturday mornings at 7:45.
Welcome back to Noon Edition. I'm Bob Zaltzberg from the Herald Times, along with Mary Catherine Carmichael. And we have three guests today. Tim Maloney is Senior Policy Advisor for the Hoosier Environmental Council. And Assistant Commissioner Scott Nally and Assistant Commissioner Dan Murray are here from the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. If you'd like to join us on the program, you can call us at 855-0811 or 877-285-9348. You can join the discussion on WFIU.org/noonedition, or you can join the discussion on Twitter. Follow at Noon Edition. So the economy, of course, is the overriding issue for a lot of people, a lot of businesses, a lot of organizations as we start slugging through 2009. What's the state of the economy meant for the environment in Indiana and for environmental protection?
Well, for one thing, there's just the overall state budget, and that's one I'll let Scott talk about a little bit. But in the regulatory program realm, what we've done is we're trying to help facilities right now that are either closing their plants altogether or closing down portions of their processes. Many times when you shut down a facility, you're generating new waste streams that you might not have had before. And what we have still, unfortunately, in Indiana are some contaminated properties from buildings and businesses that are no longer in operation. So we're working with them when we know that there's a facility that is planning to close, either through their notification of their employees, which must be reported to the state, or even through the newspapers. Sometimes we get information that a facility might be closing. We'll reach out to them in an assistance mode and say, hey, we understand that you're either going to be closing altogether or be slowing down. We'd like to come out there and help you understand what waste streams you might be generating, how we can help you understand what the regulatory requirements are, and to manage that waste and now this equipment that may even become a waste responsibly, so that later on it doesn't become another cleanup site or another problem in a community.
Can you give us an example of a company you've worked with? You don't have to name names, but just how it's sort of played out.
Sure. Metal processing facilities. Unfortunately, there's a few of those that have closed recently. The bath that they use for their treating the metal and sometimes the coatings that they use on the metal. Now that they're closing down those facilities, that material is no longer a process material. It's now a waste material. And we make sure that they package that up properly, label it properly, and that its final destination will ensure that it's handled in a responsible manner. We'd like to be there and help them through that process. And even if we find something at the time that might be a paperwork problem, we're there to help them. We want to prevent there from being a problem down the road when they close the doors. We've all heard the horror stories of a building closed up and you open it up a year later and find that there's all this waste abandoned essentially. So we're helping them through that process and making sure that they're following their environmental responsibilities.
Kokomo had a situation like that when the steel plant closed, and that ended up being one of the biggest Superfund sites, if not the biggest Superfund site ever. I assume that's exactly what you're trying to avoid.
That's exactly what we're trying to avoid, right?
Got some other questions I want to ask about the economic impact of what's going on around the country, but we have to go back to the phones. John, go ahead.
Hello. Coal is really big business in Indiana. One of your speakers use the expression clean coal. Which my amateur understanding is not correct. I mean, you burn coal, you got a lot of bad stuff to deal with no matter what. Could somebody expand on that, please?
Sure, I'd be happy to. And you're exactly correct. When you burn coal, you do produce waste and emissions, air pollutants from that process. When we talk about clean coal, what they're doing is gasifying the coal through heat and pressure. It's not burning. They're simply pulling the volatile gases out of the coal. Then you can clean up those gases, take the pollutants out of the gases, which would be now similar to natural gas. Remove the pollutants before you burn the natural gas in a turbine, and then you can handle those pollutants before they're ever emitted. That's what we mean by clean coal. What we're also finding is that the future of coal in a climate change or greenhouse gas controlled society, which we are moving in that direction, is that we're going to have to capture the CO2 also from these processes. And gasifying coal also provides that opportunity to be able to capture the CO2 before it's emitted. Because once it's emitted, we're finding it's just nearly impossible, if not just simply cost prohibitive, to be able to control CO2 at the end of the pipe. Mm-hmm. In a gasification technology, you can remove even the CO2 along with the other pollutants prior to it actually being emitted.
And what do you do with it?
Well, today there's many different projects that are in place to try to show what we can do with it in an environmentally responsible manner. But carbon sequestration in geologic formations is one that is in use today across the world, not here in a very large extent in the United States. However, there are a few pilot projects.
So are you talking about pumping it into the ground into a porous material, much like you store natural gas underground?
Similar, although don't picture it as being a large open void where you're going to fill it with CO2. You're looking at the pore space between the rocks and the grains and so on, or displacing maybe salt water that's in geologic formations thousands of feet below the surface, displacing that with CO2, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we have that kind of we can do that here in southern Indiana.
Right, southern Indiana is a prime place to give that a try.
Now, this coal gasification is not really a new technology. It's been around for a long time.
It has.
A very long time, in fact. But it's the latter part of the process that is new to the equation, the cleaning up part of it. Okay. All right.
Right.
All right. Tim?
I want to make sure I understand everything.
On the question of clean coal, certainly there are technologies that allow us to reduce the environmental impact of using coal to produce power. But just the nature of the fuel is that it's never going to be environmentally benign. When you mine and burn coal, you have a lot of environmental aspects to it, and the mining of coal has many environmental impacts that are of concern, and particularly here these days is mountaintop removal that's going on in the Appalachian region of America. that is having huge environmental impacts. So we're not going to eliminate all those impacts. The technology in some respects is still not at a commercial scale, particularly geologic sequestration. So, you know, again, all those problems, while we're going to be using coal for a while and we need to do it as safely as we can, we still need much greater emphasis on moving to a cleaner energy technologies.
Does your group hold out any long-term hope for coal, or is it your hope, the Hoosier Environmental Council's hope, that it would be more of a stopgap measure until we come up with some better long-term solutions?
Yeah, I'd say it's a stopgap measure that, mm-hmm. I mean, ultimately we're going to have the technology to greatly reduce using fossil fuels for energy. And there is a great deal of work being done in that regard right now.
Mm-hmm. All right. Our phone number is 855-0811, 877-285-9348. Follow us on Twitter. It's at Noon Edition. And you can also visit us, wfiu.org/Noon Edition. We have a phone call.
Okay.
So let's go to Kenneth. Kenneth?
I was wondering on the mercury in the streams, I mean, what chemical forms that in, and does it sit on the bottom? I mean, if they quit putting out mercury pollution in the coal power plant, how long would it take to clean up? What would happen?
You're kind of breaking up there, but I think Dan may have understood.
Yeah, I think I understood, Kenneth. As Scott mentioned, mercury atmospheric deposition is a global problem. Most of the mercury deposited here in Indiana is not generated in Indiana, and a large percentage of that is not generated in the United States. However, what happens is it is either deposited on the land or onto the surface waters. That which is deposited on the land, some of that runs off into the surface water. Once it settles down into the sediments of the streams, ponds, and lakes, it in this oxygen-deprived environment now down in the sediments, that muck down at the bottom of that water body, it transforms to methylmercury. And then the benthic organisms will take up that methylmercury, and then it just moves right on up the food chain and into the fish to where they're then have enough mercury in it that, you know, it's unsafe to eat, you know, an amount of that fish in a period of time. So that's the process through atmospheric deposition.
Okay, I mean, that's what happens, but
how long would it take to reduce it?
Is it going to take nature to clean it up, or do we have to have a big cleanup like PCBs? I mean, what?
It will eventually work itself out of the system. As we continue to reduce mercury emissions, which we are working with, and as Tim mentioned, the mercury rule for Indiana, unfortunately the federal rule, which is what we were following, was vacated. That delayed our controlling mercury further. It will work its way out of that system, but it's going to be, again, contingent a large extent on how much mercury is being emitted elsewhere in the world. It can stay active in the atmosphere, not even being deposited, for a year, just moving around the globe before it's deposited. So we can start reducing now. We'll start to see that improvement, but it is going to take some time. I don't know exactly the number of years as we're reducing it. It's something needs to be addressed globally, though.
Yeah, I just wondered if it would be 10 years or 1,000 years or whatever.
Yeah, what the half-life type
sure,
of thing
no,
is.
Sure, no, I can speak to that, Kenneth. I would say what we found is 10 to 12 years you'll start to see improvements, but probably 20 to 50 years before you're actually seeing fish without mercury in them if we were to stop emitting mercury and then through this deposition and food system.
Okay, well, how about acid rain and the sulfur? I haven't heard anything mentioned about that.
Okay, well, the acid rain program did a lot. It cut SO2 emissions by roughly half. However, the Clean Air Interstate rule now has further reductions on SO2. Acid rain today isn't a problem. What we do have still, though, from SO2 emissions or sulfur dioxide is we still do have visibility problems. We do have fine particulate matter in the air that is a respiratory problem from sulfur dioxide.
So is that smog?
Yes, it is one of the components of smog. Yes, it is. However, the Clean Air Interstate rule over the next I'd say 5 years, because there's a 2012 and a 2015 attainment deadline, that we should see significant reductions in SO2 emissions well beyond what the acid rain program produced.
All right. Yeah. All right, Kenneth.
Okay. Well, I can do one more.
Yeah, we've got very quickly.
Okay. I was wondering about the – it wasn't about the acid rain, but it was wouldn't it be less pollution if we brought in Western hard coal instead of burning local coal? Mm-hmm. Indiana coal is horrible.
Okay, let's we'll answer that one, and then if you have more, call back.
Sure. Right. The use of Indiana coal, which we do want to see our state's natural resources used, it's a balancing act. And how states comply with the air regulations is through a balance of using Indiana coal and Western coal. Or if you choose to use Indiana coal, you are going to need more aggressive pollution control equipment to remove the pollutants. So we do want to still see Indiana coal used. Some use it by blending it with Western coal to reduce the amount of pollutants. Others choose to put on more and better efficient pollution control devices to remove those pollutants.
Tim, you were wanting to talk earlier. I don't know if you
– Well, I was just going to add something to Dan's comments about mercury. There are a number of studies around the United States and elsewhere that show when you make local reductions in mercury emissions, you do start seeing reductions in environmental mercury pretty quickly. So it also makes the link that there's a local impact as well as the impact of global emissions.
So that's nice. You feel like you have a little more power in your own backyard. That's
yes.
Important.
Mm-hmm.
Can we follow up on that just a little bit? When we're talking about a worldwide problem, we have to talk about a worldwide solution, and certainly we look to our national government for our help along those lines. Two questions for you, Tim. What is your the Hoosier Environmental Council's national affiliation? I assume there probably is one. And then what kind of promises or work are you looking for out of this new administration regarding environmental impacts from other places in the world?
Mm-hmm. Well, on the first part, the Hoosier Environmental Council is a homegrown group. We're a state-level group with no formal affiliation with national groups, although we network with regional and national mm-hmm. groups and collaborate in many respects. But, I mean, we're just an Indiana group.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yep. On the second question, we have a lot of hope for the new administration on the whole range of environmental problems, and we're seeing a lot of quick action already. You know, the new president has said in crisis there's opportunity, and boy, he's taking that to heart and moving forward on a lot of energy policy. The stimulus bill had a lot of funding for energy programs and public transit and passenger rail. All things that are desperately in need of
implementation.
Yeah, implementation and support. So, we're seeing good signs, and we hope that's going to translate into a lot of specific actions.
Okay, great.
All right, we have less than 10 minutes to go in the program. We have two callers and an email that I know of, and probably have more out there. Let's go to the phone first, and Jennifer.
Hi. This question is, I guess the basis of the question is how much interagency communication in Indiana, like, does IDEM do? Because it doesn't make a lot of sense to be concerned with capturing the CO2 from coal burning, you know, while the Division of Forestry is increasing the harvesting of trees on state property by a factor of whatever, 7 or 10 or... do you communicate with them, or do they just not care, or what's the deal here?
Scott?
Yeah, I can address that. Actually, we communicate regularly with all our sister agencies. We have both formal and informal communication. The formal one is we meet us, DNR, NDOT on certain projects on a quarterly basis, and then we have more of an informal where pick up the phone, go downstairs, we're quick on email on it. But we also have, back on the formal one, a lot of MOUs, that memorandum of understandings with our sister agencies, where we have clearly carved out the very interaction that the caller talked about, and then how are each of the agencies in the big picture going to play in that arena. And then, of course, it's always escalated to the commissioner level, which then gets to the governor's cabinet level.
Yeah, specifically to the point that you brought up, Jennifer, on carbon sequestration, is the governor's office has pulled together a group that is an interagency climate change group, and we're working right now to understand what are our inventory of CO2 emissions in the state and what are our sequestration capabilities with forestry and also with the geologic formations in Indiana. So the state forester and I are both on that group, and we talk regularly about our state's ability to sequester as much CO2 here in Indiana as possible before we have to look for solutions elsewhere.
All right, Jennifer, thanks a lot for the call. And let's go next to Al. Al?
Yes, I have two questions. In an acute problem situation, if the local authorities either fail to or decline to take effective action, after hours, on a weekend, what should citizens do to try to put a halt to a major pollution problem? And the second one would be, with that carbon sequestration program where you're going to pump it underground, what are the chances of acid decomposition of the subsurface rock and lubrication of inner strata surfaces, causing bringing about some earthquakes, as happened in Colorado when the Rocky Mountain Arsenal was pumping stuff underground.
Hmm. All right, two questions.
I'll take on the first one. I'm Scott Nally.
Yes.
And I just lost my train of thought. I'm sorry.
After hours. Response.
After hours. Yes, please. We have a complaint line that is info.in.gov. that you can get online anonymously and send in a text message or an email address.
How about a phone number also?
Or a phone number. We have it. I don't have that one memorized. Well, it's on our website again.
800-451-6027.
Thank you, Dan.
Who will answer that at midnight?
At midnight, it'll actually go to a call box, and then we will call you back. Unless it's a spill. If it's a spill that you're reporting, that is staff 24/7.
All right. And when is the callback?
The callback will be immediately the next morning. Okay. We have somebody that staffs that at 8 o'clock in the morning. Uh-huh. Well, now, Al, on this one, be fair. So you call in at, say, midnight, and you report the issue. We pick up the phone at 8 o'clock. If it's not a spill, if it is a spill, call our spill line, and we'll have somebody out there probably that night.
What if it's a fire that's polluting an entire valley?
Then we would be out there first thing the next morning, because immediately our complaint coordinator, Tanya, immediately gets those calls, funnels them right down to the program, air, water, or land, whatever media that is of the issue, and then they immediately send out a compliance inspector if need.
And everybody in the valley would already been exposed to the pollutants for the entire evening. The fire would be out, and in all probability, and you might find the evidence destroyed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good point.
Well, if there was a fire like that and there were firefighters out there, would they, if they saw a danger, would they contact you immediately?
They immediately call us.
Uh-huh. And what if they fail to do that?
If they fail to do that, then that's the only mechanism we would know. Unfortunately, we can't look into the crystal ball, but a prime example was the Indianapolis fire that happened night before last. And that blaze started up at about 3:10. I was immediately up at 3:30, and we had first responders out there with the fire department in Indianapolis that early morning. I was in the office a little after 5:30. We were already coordinating with Dan on our monitors to make sure that we didn't have toxins and other issues. That's how it works.
Okay. All right.
We do rely on the local relationships we have, though, to rely on police and fire to be able to contact us. On your question about carbon sequestration and acids forming and lubrication of fault lines and other things that could lead to earthquakes, right now there are many different sequestration pilot projects out there. We are learning about it literally as we speak here, Al. And the proposed formations we're talking about here in Indiana are thousands of feet below the surface, not ones that if there was an acid formation problem, we're very far below any drinking water sources or any other sources of potable water that could be put at risk. But as far as fault lines and other type of disturbances that could lead to earthquakes, that's why we have the pilot projects out there now to understand these relationships and whether or not there could be any public safety issues created. So jury's out on that still.
Okay. Thanks, Al. Here's one that came in from chat, apparently. How exciting. When will IDEM restore the various grants that they suspended in December?
I can take that one. Actually, we have 117 grants in our program, and only three grants were temporarily suspended out of the 117. We were asked as an agency, as with all other agencies, to look at areas that we could temporarily put in stasis so that we maintained a cash balance, not knowing what the projected revenue streams were going to be. It'd be just like yourself at home trying to manage your checkbook, and if you have a predictor out there that says you're gas bills getting ready to double or triple, or some of your other streams that you have to write checks against is going to increase, or if you just took a pay cut, in this case our projected revenues are missed, you start to put some process in place to catch it as early on as you can. And that's what we did. We staced or slowed down three of our grant programs. In this case, we temporarily suspended them about 18 months, to be specific on that. We're looking at about 18 months for the state of Indiana to start to come out of the cycle where we think it makes good sense to reinstitute those three programs. But in the meantime, we have 114 of them that are going forward.
Sounds like you got about 13 months left then for mm-hmm. the ones that are suspended.
Correct. Right, we have 1 minute to go. Tim?
As far as the grants, I think we should also look more broadly at the state's overall spending on the environment and just how poor our record has been, which you know is not unique to this administration. It's been going on for some time. About 1% of Indiana's state budget is spent on conservation in the environment, funding IDEM and DNR. And if we want to provide a truly quality environment that benefits our economy and our people, we've got to do much better than that.
All right. And we are out of time. And we'll revisit the environment soon on Noon Edition, I'm sure. I want to thank Tim Maloney, Scott Nally, and Dan Murray for being here with us today. For Mary Catherine Carmichael, producer Ariana Prothero, and engineer Mike Bashkash, I'm Bob Zaltzberg. Thanks for listening.
Noon Edition is a production of WFIU and the Herald Times. A podcast of this and other WFIU programs is available at wfiu.org.
Production support comes from Closets 2, providing organized and expanded closet and storage space for home, office, and garage using a variety of systems with no major renovations. Closets 2, owned and operated in Bloomington, 332-2233. Smithville Telephone Company, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, offering bundled packages, high-speed internet, and wireless phones. Smithville Telephone, local pride, global technology, information at smithville.net.